Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fode, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Will Arntz, who reads from and discusses his provocative book, What the Bleep Do We Know? Discovering the Endless Possibilities for Altering Your Everyday Reality, published by HCI. In the weeks to come, we have Joan Didion, Andrew Weil, Lynn Truss, Blair Underwood, Chris Elliott, Elliot Perlman, Frank McCourt, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Thank you for supporting independent bookselling and to welcome you here this evening. The independent film, What the Bleep Do We Know, was a riveting phenomenon that bent genres and minds with its heady mixture of science, spirituality, and personal empowerment. Now the filmmakers have created the full-color, fully illustrated book of the decade right here. We are delighted to welcome filmmaker, producer, writer Will Arntz here to present What the Bleep Do We Know, Discovering the Endless Possibilities for Altering Your Everyday Reality. William graduated summa cum laude from Penn State. He then accepted employment as a research physicist with Pratt & Whitney Aircraft. He then ventured on to create a highly successful software company in 1995. He sold this company, took a year off, and then created a successful second software company, which he sold 9 months after creating it. And this is direct from their fabulous website, which I hope you've all visited, What the Bleep Do We Know, whatthebleep.com. And I quote from it, "After retiring for the third time, he became interested in uniting his four great interests, leading-edge science, spiritual inquiry, filmmaking, and computers. After realizing that with the success of his two software companies, he has succeeded in bypassing the onerous task of rising through the ranks, he happily, despite still lacking common sense," as they say on the website, "embarked upon the creation of What the Bleep Do We Know." And boy, aren't we glad he is. Please welcome to the Tattered Cover, Will Arntz.
Well, here we are. This is going to be difficult. I always pace when I talk. So, where's the iPod thing? So if I pace, I'll take it with me. Oh, I can do this thing. I'm on a short leash today, though. So, you know, hopefully I won't get too... Well, that's the limit here. So, welcome. Thank you, everyone, for coming. A lot of people showed up. That's great. Should I talk first? You want to just do Q&A or... I don't know. I just... Right. Talk. I want to talk. You don't talk enough anymore. We never talk anymore. So, so you're here in the book. We didn't really decide to do the book. The way this stuff always works with this project is we just, HCI came to us, they're a publisher, and they are the ones who did all the Chicken Soup for the Soul books. So one person who works for them said, "Oh, there's this great movie," and they said, "Oh, they got to do a book on this." So they approached us, and they said, "We want you to do a book." And at that point, I was busy editing the new version of the movie that's coming out in theaters sometime in January, the infamous Rabbit Hole version. And yeah, what we did for that is we yanked all the old interviews out of the movie, pretty much. We re-interviewed everyone, interviewed a few extra people, did a 15 minutes of new animation, basically kind of restructured everything, took some old scenes from Amanda that didn't make it into the movie, put them in, took some other ones out. We basically just like refried beans the whole thing. And now, you know, we're going to release it. It's like 2.5 hours long. And it has a lot more science in it than the original movie did. So I'm working on that, and they said, "Oh, you want to do the book?" And I said, "No, we're busy." And then Betsy said, there's three of us, really, Mark, Betsy, and myself. There's really three of us who have done this stuff. And we're kind of, people always says, "What have you done? What have they done?" It's kind of like a rock band. We don't really necessarily keep track of that, but we fight a lot. I guess it's good for the creative juices. So although the fightings, we've sort of at this point gotten tired of all the fighting. We get tired of all the chemicals, you know. We're like, "It's not worth the chemicals. We don't want to fight anymore." So they came and said, "We want you to write a book and to take these ideas further." And I said, "No way, I'm busy." Betsy said, "But they have a big advance." really? You know, they said, yeah, they want to do it. And so we said, okay, well, I guess maybe people are interested, because we've had a lot of people say we're interested in more stuff. So we sat down and wrote a book. And it was interesting, because HCI is very much a self-help book company. You know, self-help books, I rarely read them, because I don't know, I'm just too much of a rebel to have anyone tell me what I should do. And self-help books are generally the sort of thing like, well, in order to find the divine in us all, which we so often miss, yet we touch so rarely in our everyday life, we must take a moment and center ourselves and find that divine spark so rarely seen. You know, they go on like that for pages. You know, and we're more like, look, idiots. We're idiots too, and here's how we bang our heads against the wall. That's kind of more of our style. So we started writing in that style, and of course HCI was like, we don't know that the people, we said, well, why do you think the movie was successful? I mean, you know, it's called What the Bleep Do We Know? It's not like we have it all figured out. So they got used to it. So that's the book thing. So now it's done, and we're all kind of surprised that there's a book. I mean, because it's all, people say, you know, did you have this whole thing planned out? It's like, oh, that's a joke. You know, and weird things keep happening. Like we have the bleep groups. This is weird. Has anyone heard about the bleep groups? Yeah, this is a weird phenomena. So the movie comes out, and we start getting all these emails, people saying, you know, well, we really like the information. We're really, you know, intrigued by it, but we want more. And we're all thinking, well, we're kind of a little, you know, spent right now. There is no more. But hey, we want to get together and have these talks, because we have had the most, we got all these emails, people saying, you know, we had the most interesting conversations we had had in years after watching your movie, which was great. That's what we wanted. So we want to keep having the conversation. So these bleep groups started forming, where they just get together. And eventually we hooked up with IONS, which is the Institute for Noetic Science. And we did a study guide that people can download. And these are springing up all over, well, it used to be all over the country. Now it's all over the world. Because it turns out people are really interested in, you know, they find it more interesting than baseball batting averages, I guess. So, you know, they find the discussion better. So, yeah, that's all happening. And it's just all, what was the latest thing I heard? Because you get these things come in. One was, we just set the record in Mexico for a documentary in theaters. We've done the most box office of any documentary ever in Mexico. So now all the Mexicans are writing us, and they want us to come down there. It's very, you know, it's quite exciting. I don't know what to talk about. Does anyone have any questions? I'm done talking. Yahoo! How to go from physics to quantum physics? Well, the way that it worked was, when I was in college, I was really interested in all the really weird physics, quantum and relativity and stuff like that. And for some reason, I was always interested in what is time. Don't know why, but I was interested in what is time. And I kept thinking that if I studied enough physics, that that eventually they were going to tell me what time is on some basic level. And I took all this physics, and eventually I got to the point where it was like, they never say what time is. It's something that a clock measures. But what is the nature of time? Can you go forward and backwards? And I was just really interested. I don't know why. Maybe it was the 60s. And all those chemical memories, right? So, who knows why, but I was interested in that. And it just wasn't kind of getting there to what that stuff fundamentally was. And then I started, you know, reading the metaphysical books, because that's kind of their, they at least take a crack at it. You know, they say clever things like time doesn't exist. That helps a lot. But they say time doesn't exist. And so you can go forward and backwards in time, and everything's happening simultaneously. And, you know, time is just something we created, so it doesn't all happen at once because we couldn't deal with it. Blah, blah, blah. Not that this is really helping much, but, you know, so I started all the metaphysical stuff. But I would skip all the stuff where you were supposed to meditate and work on yourself and purify yourself, because that was like, you know, who cares about that stuff? Yeah, I got that stuff figured out, you know. I'm interested in time, not that junk. But after about 10 years of skipping those sections, slow learner, I started getting a little more interested in the spiritual aspects of stuff. And then I met a teacher, decided I needed a teacher, and met one, and then, you know, off I went. So that's kind of how the transition went. I kind of backed into it. It's not like I had a vision one day, or that I thought, and a lot of it, see, I stayed away from all the spiritual stuff because my early experience with the church, you know, was the one where we had the discussions. I was, 14, and we were deciding whether, you know, little kid in India and hadn't been converted, we're going to go to hell or not. And the answer back then was yes. Now the it says here, you know, if you haven't blah blah blah, then blah blah blah, and it's, hope you like it hot because it's going to be hot all the time there. So that kind of turned me off in a certain respect. So it took me a while to, you know, get back into the that there's something aside from, you know, the physical. Oh, it's funny about the second one. I'll do the first one first. It's doing different countries. I mean, it's very different. It did really, really well in Australia. They loved it. In fact, per capita, it's done better there than here. The reason why is when they released it, we said, look, don't go to the main media. They're going to trash it because they don't get it. And the media, don't get me started, but they'll just, you know, do whatever. So they just said, screw that. We're just going to go talk to the yoga people and the unity people and, you know, all the people who are into the more alternatives, the, you know, the organic folks, you know, blah, 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 and let the word of mouth build. And it did really well. We released it in England, and they decided they were going to take a different approach. They were going to go to the media. And the media totally trashed it. They said... in fact, I did an interview with BBC where they brought these scientists on. It was basically an ambush they had set up for me, where they were like saying all this, and they didn't think that I knew any physics though. So the only way they dealt with me was to interrupt me every time I was halfway through my answer. They would just interrupt me. So, oh, I'm started on the media now. Here we go. No, that's a rabbit hole. So the media totally trashed it. Said all the physics, all the science was all made up. There's nothing there. It's all, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it didn't do well there. It's done well in the Netherlands. Like I said, set records in Mexico. We're now getting emails from people all over South America saying, oh, I just saw your movie in Peru. It's had this amazing thing. We're all getting together. We don't have a distributor in Peru. And I'm told now you can get dubbed Russian versions of the movie. Dubbed in Russian. We don't know how they did it because they didn't have the things to ever take the English out. I guess they just turned the English down and, you know, "Govoris po-ruski," you know, they just put that over the whole thing. So it's taken a life of its own around the world, and we just get emails from the most obscure places where, oh, I've been to the theater 5 times in the last 2 weeks. And again, we have no distributor there. So at first we got a little upset about that, but now we're thrilled because it just means that there's, you know, there's this whole thing going. Well, India, we haven't really, that's kind of tricky. We know people have seen it in China, so it's out in China. We thought it would do very well in Japan. And, you know, Dr. Emoto helped us hook up some people, but the Japanese distributors are very, very conservative. And they'll sit and wait for a year or two to decide whether it's any good or not. So we actually did a dubbed Japanese version, and people, the distributor said, well, yeah, people like it, but that's just the Emoto crowd. But that's really the same thing we had in America when we were done. They said, well, you know, it's kind of an interesting movie, but no one's going to come see it. The running joke is they said that all you folks don't exist. We said there's people out there that are interested, and they said, no, you folks don't exist. The more than running joke is, so the next time you have an identity problem, you know why. Hollywood, the media says you folks don't exist. So unfortunately, the U.S. government, the tax department thinks you do, so, you know. But that's the story on that. Now, as far as the, there was one scientist, David Albert, and he was, he had, I guess, been out of the country and he came back. You know, we came in, we filmed this documentary, and we said it was going to be theatrical, but when we told people that, they thought, oh, Mashugana, yeah, right. Quantum physics on the big screen, you know, you got to be kidding. Throwing a channeled being, I mean, yeah, you guys are really, forget about it. So he just forgot about the whole thing, and suddenly it's playing in theaters, and people are talking to him about it. And he got very, very upset because he said he was taken out of context. Now, I mean, that's something that's a call, close, you know, call, whether you took him out of context. I mean, all of his quotes were fairly long. So I think, you know, you get what he's talking about. He mostly didn't like that the people talking next to him he didn't agree with. And he fundamentally said that, you know, you didn't really put my view out there. Well, you know, it wasn't the David Albert movie, you know, in effect. And this is going to, and in fact, he got very nasty at one point and went and sent out this email that got all over the place saying we took him out of contest and he was going to sue us all for doing that. You know, and so at that point, we just sent our lawyer, sent him a very nice letter, sending a copy of the release thing that he had signed, saying, well, you can do it, but David, I think you're going to be wasting your money. But there's actually a happy ending to the story. Because what happened was there was this prophets conference that happened. This is another bizarre thing. They decided we were going to do prophets conference, they called them. That was the name of the organization that did it. And so they had a bunch of the speakers from the movie come back, and the filmmakers, and Marley was there, and a whole bunch of it. And they contacted David Albert to see if he wanted to come, because they didn't know anything about the controversy. So he said yes. So we were all like, well, this is going to be interesting. So Betsy and I called him up once. And we said, well, David, you know, we haven't talked, but, you know, I know you're upset and you're coming to this conference. We just want to have a conversation with you beforehand. And also said that we're having this extended rabbit hole version of the movie coming out. And if you really don't want to be involved in this anymore, we'll take you out. You know, we don't want you to feel misrepresented or anything like that. And so he said, well, I'd like to come to the conference anyway. And we said, fine, come on. So he came and basically gave a long presentation on how most of what was in the movie was just bull. To which some of the other scientists said, no, you're wrong about that. And they got in this like scientific fist fight in front of everyone, which was a revelation to everyone there, because they all thought scientists were like, you know, this is the way it is, and we've all agreed to these things, and if this is not the way, then it is wrong. And it turns out that that's, scientists argue all the time. And it turned out it was really interesting at the conference, because people thought it was going to be like the choir, we were going to be singing to the choir, and there was fist fights, intellectual fist fights on the stage, which we really appreciated. And so then we re-interviewed him, of all things, and said I wanted to put him in this extended version, and the agreement that I had with him is before I did anything, I would show him the clips, which he could okay. And I sent him all the clips, and he was actually happy. He goes, well, I think this puts my point out there pretty well. So, you know, it ended up, and in fact, he said, well, if there are any more prophets conference, I would kind of like to go. So yeah, that was the thing with David. Uh-huh. The same cast of characters. Yeah, cast of villains. It's pretty much the same cast of villains. We also interviewed Lynn McTaggart. She wrote this book called The Field. Very, very interesting book if you folks are interested in this kind of stuff to read. And then we interviewed Dean Radin. Now, if you don't know who Dean Radin is, Dean is the head scientist at the Institute for Noetic Sciences. If you don't know what that is, that's this. The story goes, Ed Mitchell was this astronaut, and he was coming back from the moon. And he was coming back, and when he was on the moon, he was doing these ESP experiments to see if anything would happen. He was coming back from the moon, and at one point he looked out of the capsule, and he had this total mystical cosmic experience where he suddenly felt connected to the entire universe, that his body was not the end of him, and then the fact that it extended infinitely out, and he was part of everything, and everything was just like you read in all the mystical books, right? You know, that's what we all hope for. Someday we're going to sit down and meditate and like, whoa, I'm everything. Well, he actually had that experience. He came back, and he was the only astronaut who ever had a PhD from MIT, of all places. And so he said, you know, everyone in the world is not like they've been telling me in physics class. This whole thing about entanglement, we're all connected. So he formed the Institute for Noetic Science to do serious scientific inquiry into paranormal psychic phenomena. Dean Radin is his top scientist, who's done all these neat experiments with random event generators. And a lot of these are in the book, so I won't go into them. We have quotes from Dean and Edgar in the book, too. But we went, in the book and the later movies, we went much more towards more of the experimental data. Like Bill Tiller, one of the guys we interviewed in the first movie, he'd done these things where people focus on these little black boxes to change the physical attributes of systems, like to change the pH, and it actually works. And, you know, he's done impeccable research on that. And so in the book, we sort of get into the thing like, well, there's all this impeccable research in mainstream science. You know, they react to it like this. I mean, that's, you know, if that doesn't work, then they get into name-calling, basically. So, like in the book, there's a little bit of like, come on, guys. You know, if this stuff is hokum, like you said it is, then do scientifically show us how it's hokum. Because otherwise, you're just giving us your opinion. And as Clint Eastwood said, no, I won't say that. Some people have seen that movie. Okay, so that's, did I answer your question without being too crazy? Uh-huh. That was pretty much mine. Because I had done a movie many, many years ago with animation, and I always liked animation. And in order to tell some of the concepts, you really kind of need the animation. I mean, you can talk about the neuronets forever, But until you actually see them and get some sense of they can go in there and rewire, then of course once you get the picture of the neuronets in your neuronets, then you want to rewire. And we've gotten emails from people saying, oh, since that now, I just visualize. And it's the visualization. I do sound effects too. It's the visualization of everything that really makes it real. So, and some of the stuff like when she walks on the basketball court, we had this analogy of the blue grid. And the blue grid is sort of this interconnecting grid that connects all the beings and all humans and all everything together. That was a concept that they talk about a lot at the Rompthe School where I go. And so it's this interconnecting web. And so in order to do that, that was the whole blue grid thing, the blue grid of possibilities. And, you know, you can talk about possibilities all you want, but when you see them as these bubbles, it makes it much more real. And the other reason I did it was I knew with all the ideas and the talking heads in it, it was going to get a little dense at a certain point. So at a certain point, you kind of need a break. And the whole thing about nice animation is it's fun to watch. On some level, you just like watching it. And then, of course, there was the silliness with the little cells. Yeah, that was just my adolescent sense of humor. No, not the red one. Not the red one. That wasn't me. No. Yeah. That's not denial either. Hi. You know, it's really interesting, the proof. How do you prove it? Like Dean Radin, for instance, has done these experiments where he has random event generators, number generators, where you focus on, and basically it's a random process supposedly where it produces ones or zeros. And you get someone in a room and they say, okay, try to make more ones than zeros. Sure enough, it's 52% ones, 48% zeros. Doesn't sound like much. Statistically speaking, the chance of doing that is 50,000 to 1, that just by randomly it would do that. Now, is that a proof? Well, random is random. Well, but they've done that. I mean, they've done the stuff, they've published it 50,000 to 1, but they'll say something like, well, that doesn't prove it because that's just statistics. No, you hear this all the time. The argument is that's just statistics. And then you say, hello, quantum mechanics is just statistics. Didn't you hear about the probability wave functions? And then the answer to that is that's different. No, it's an interesting thing about skeptics because at one point we ran into the guy who publishes Skeptic Magazine. What's his name? Shermer. Someone Shermer. And, you know, if you get a real skeptic, a true skeptic is really quite a find because a true skeptic says, look, I don't buy you, I don't buy this, I don't buy this, I want to see proof. Most of what we've found from skeptics is they're not skeptical at all. They have it figured out, and they want to trash someone who doesn't agree with them. I mean, 98% of the time. Now, it was interesting. What we found out David Albert was, he was a skeptic, but he was perfectly willing to sit there and debate till the cows come home what it was. And, you know, if you came up with something and said, no, it's like this way, David, he would stop and, you know, he would really think it. So, you know, a real skeptic is, you know, it's part of the whole, you know, discussion and process that you need. Unfortunately, most of the skeptics basically say, look, UFOs don't exist. We're out to disprove it. You're not being a skeptic if you're doing that. You should say, look, a lot of people have reported UFOs. What is the valid basis for that? But, you know, but we get that all the time. So the best thing is go to the website. But there's a book that was written years and years ago. It's called The White Book. The White Book. It's just, and it's a clever title. The cover's white. And and it really kind of lays out Rompthe's basic take on many things in a very clear way that when you read it, you just understand it. So that's really the best thing. Anyone over there thinking about? Hello? I never followed. I mean, I knew who Yuri was and how and all that stuff, but, you know, I never really found out what, you know, I never investigated all that stuff as to where, because I know there was a challenge and supposedly it didn't work and then it did work, and I just don't know much about that. Yeah, I was talking to someone, who was I talking to recently, who actually had met Yuri Geller a bunch of times and said he was a real, I mean, he was, he seemed to be able, because they saw him do some really bizarre stuff. Told the story about one time he was walking in through this town and he just kind of felt a little odd for a moment and looked around. He was in his apartment 20 miles away. And he checked his clock. There's nowhere he could have done it. So it was like sometimes just things would happen. like that. So, you know, we never really have gotten into all of that much. Well, there was Stanford stuff. Yeah, I mean, the really all the big government research. There's all this stuff coming out now about the government, their psychic spy stuff with remote viewing, and the Russians were doing it. So the CIA got really worried about that, and you know, the results they were getting were some pretty interesting results on the remote viewing. Then they were doing other stuff where they were trying to figure out if someone could use their mind to like jam. You know, if you want to take down an airplane, you can try shooting it down, but if you can just make one computer bit fire the wrong thing, the program will crash and down the plane goes. So they were trying to figure out whether, you know, typical planet Earth stuff. You know, the government got very interested because there was this whole thing. So it's as much as I know. But the bleep do I know? Uh-huh. Did everyone hear the question? Basically, is why did we choose Marley to be in the movie, especially she was deaf? Was that something that we had, you know, figured that would be really good? We had written the movie, finally got a script written, and we were going to shoot in Portland. And it was about a month before shooting, and we'd been sending the script out to various actresses, and they pretty much were all saying no, because it was a weird film, no one's going to come see it, you know, blah, blah, blah. So we were starting to wonder what to do, and the clock was ticking, because in Portland, by mid-October, it starts to rain, and then it rains for 8 months. So we had to, you know, we basically had to get this thing, and we're preparing, and we didn't know what to do. And at one point, there's a thing that's called breakdown service, where the casting director will put a script where we're looking for people out on the web, and then other agents can look at it. So Marley's agent is always looking for scripts that would work for Marley. And we had written the script so there wasn't a whole lot of dialogue in that, because there's all the talking heads. We wanted to show, not tell. So he reads the script and he goes, oh my God, this would be perfect for Marley. So basically he calls us up and says, Marley's interested. And Mark and Betsy said, really? And I said, what? You got to be kidding. No way. You know, because I had written the dialogue for a man. And I said, you know, she would not know. But they said, well, we should take a meeting. I said, okay, that's what people in Hollywood do. Let's do it. So we took a meeting. And during the meeting, meanwhile, the clock's ticking. And I still wasn't that convinced, but Mark and Betsy said this could work. But overall, our sense was that this was a point at which we'd been working on this film for like 2 years at that point, that there's a part in the creative process where it's like the thing that you're creating starts taking over. And your role is to shut up and get out of the way. And we kind of thought this was a shut up and get out of your way thing, and that the universe was kind of saying, this is your gal, and the clock was ticking. And so we had the meeting and then thought, well, can I rewrite the script so it'll work? And they said, yeah, because it wasn't that. The character actually changed a lot. In the beginning, the character was kind of like a friend of mine that is kind of very like cheerful and optimistic, but they kind of trip over their own feet almost because they know too much about themselves, that they pick too much stuff up, and then they see, because then they're aware of where it doesn't work, and they make sort of self-deprecating and funny in that respect. The person was supposed to be kind of funny, and Marley comes off as being kind of angry. You should have seen some of the takes. So she also just had a child four weeks before we filmed, or something, 5 weeks. I mean, it was amazing that she really wanted to do it. I know it. And she ended up doing, of course, an amazing job. But it really ended up working out well, that because of that, it really sort of, because she's not interacting with people the way, you know, we normally do, that it sort of pulls you more into her internal world. And it was one of those divine fiats that it just kind of all worked out that way. But we were thankful. Yeah, she lightened up a little towards the end. It turns out interesting that scene in the bathroom. She said that was the hardest acting she has ever done in her life. The reason why, it was like, Marley, this is your life, and you know, because it's this whole thing about loving your body or hating your body and whatnot. And she did not want to do the scene. I will not do the scene. She says, we'll just use a body double for it. We said, well, that's great, Marley. In the end, it's your call, but don't you think that kind of defeats the purpose of the scene? I mean, you know, it's like about loving your body kind of, you know, and you think your hips are out here, or, you know, you think you have, you know, fat legs and you don't, or you think you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So don't you think that's kind of the point of the whole thing? And she said, well, but you don't understand, like, acting is my profession, and people expect you to be a certain way. So if they see you're not that way, then it's going to be a problem. We said, well, Marley, don't you think that's kind of a problem? I mean, if you, then everyone, you know, all the women have to expect to look like the airbrushed people in People magazine. I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about. But it was very difficult for her. I mean, I don't want to put down Marley's thing, because that was her impression, and, you know, and the world's looking a certain way. And so all three of us would have to take turns talking to Marley about it. And finally, in the end, Mark convinced her. He just said, you know, look, you're an artist, aren't you? Yeah? Well, don't you think? I mean, this is about communicating a certain something. Don't you think you could really communicate this thing that you have about loving your body? So that day she came in, she was so upset. When she hits the mirror, I don't know if you hear this smack, she breaks the mirror. If you look closely, there's some blood on the mirror. That's from the earlier take when she hit the mirror, and she hit it so hard that she broke the mirror and cut herself on the wrist right there. It was almost the end of filming for that day, because she was so worked up about that. And she said that she didn't sleep we found this out later, for the 2 weeks before filming that scene, she didn't sleep, and she said that night was the best she had maybe ever slept. It was such a catharsis for her to do that. And, you know, we all thought that she was such a hero for doing that, because, you know, if you ever get on her website, send her an email and tell her she's a hero, because it really, I mean, for her to do that, and she was, it is her profession. People have expectations, but in order to communicate that, she pushed beyond her fears and pushed beyond her limitations and all the stuff we're talking about in the movie to do that. And that's why it's such a gripping scene, because it was real. Uh-huh. Did everyone hear that question? That's a great question. No, it really is. He said that if the movie is founded basically on you saying that a lot of the spiritual things are based on quantum physics, what happens when, like, if you look at the history of science, 50 years from now, quantum physics is going to be like, well, that was an interesting approximation, but it's not the way reality is. So sort of you're saying, what about the spiritual things? Part of what we've all been going through a process of learning in making this. And part of it, when we were doing it originally, it seemed that quantum physics was proving a lot of these things. And what we've learned is, it's not that so this thing we're talking about proof, what is proof? And it doesn't necessarily prove it, but it certainly suggests that there are parallels between a lot of these psychic things going on and the physics. Like the whole bit about the observer. How does the observer affect reality? Well, they know it. The observer affects reality. There's no question about that. But the question that comes in, is it a conscious observer, or is it just a measuring device that does it? Putting a measuring device seems to affect a quantum state. And it's not the conscious observer. But then again, how do you know that unless you look at it? So this debate is still raging on in physics. So kind of the thing that I'm learning now is a lot of it, it's very suggestive of it. Like this whole bit about entanglement, where everything's connected, where you take two particles, separate them to different sides of the universe. You do something over here, it affects this one. They can be on the other sides of the universe, and you flip this one, and this one instantaneously flips. It's like information traveled infinitely fast across the universe, and how could one electron keep a track of another electron? I mean, it's all very bizarre. Furthermore, they say, since everything was entangled at the Big Bang, everything is still connected, meaning everything is still all existing in one point. I mean, that's quantum theory says that. Does that prove the mystical assertion that the mystics always say, we are all one, we are all connected, we are only God, and there is only one God self, and that's everything? I mean, does it prove it? Well, not QED, thus it's proven, but it's very suggestive of that. So I think that really it's more of looking at about analogies like that to say it, because you're right. At a certain point, they may say quantum physics doesn't describe. I think what's going to happen is they're going to get to the point where they say, because if you look at traditional mechanistic quantum physics, it says that there's nothing that affects random event generators. It'll always be 50-50. But now these experiments say, well, consciousness seems to be affecting these things, and we can see it easier at the quantum level than we can. It's easier to push a random event generator to 52% than it is for me to manifest an elephant on that chair. So quantum seems to be much more subjective to the mental stimuli or the thought process. And, you know, a lot of people think that that's where the explanation will come, on that sort of link-up. But, you know, it's sort of like building a house on sand. because you know physics is going to change, and you know, and in the book, we took I would say a more neutral approach to that whole thing, saying look, in fact, we talk about this observer thing with the measurement problem, and saying, does the observer? Because still, I mean, the debate still rages on this. I was talking to Jeff Satinover, who's kind of more on the materialistic side than the spiritual side, and he was saying, you know, you would think this simple thing of is it a conscious observer or a measurement affect a quantum system? Which one collapses reality? Is there some? And he said the debate is still raging on that 40 years later. And you would think something like that, and we're just talking about a couple of electrons, that they would have figured out. So there's some sort of mystery going on here. So in other words, it's a work in progress. You know, and to the point that you say it's not a work in process, we have it figured out. That was one of my problems with a lot of traditional religions, is at a certain point they often will say, look, this is how it is, it never changes, we had the word from on high, we don't want to hear it. And, you know, we definitely don't want to get into that sort of thing of saying, like, this is where we're putting our stake in, and that's the way it is for all time, and, you know, see you later. Because 50,000 years from now, you know, who knows what will happen? Unless it's already happening now. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, the question was about Dr. Emoto's work and whether, you know, because he said that's a place open to much scientific questions. So what's happened on that is the Institute for Noetic Science has gotten very interested in that. In fact, Dean Radin now is going to take over and do a bunch of these experiments to see if he can replicate it. And Dean is, you know, PhD and this and that, and is as a researcher, is really impeccable. And apparently there's some people in Germany now doing it. So we expect over the next couple, because it made such a big splash, no pun intended, in the movies, that, because it created such waves, because it was such a, let's all groan together. So should I keep going? No. Because, you know, it did all that stuff that people are now interested in checking it out. And you're right, because that was one of the criticisms that said, that's just, you know, all hokum. Which? Ah. Well, I mean the whole thing about, people, like I did this interview today where this woman was telling me, I guess she's writing an article for Westwood. Is she here? Is Jessica here? Didn't make it. We're about this woman who's basically doing a line of linen that has all these like wonderful affirmations written all over these sheets, you know, so you get in the bed at night, you know, you love yourself and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, a lot of that stuff. So are you praying over your food now?
Yeah.
Good. As far as it affects the life, I mean, there's lots of different ways. And it's kind of funny, like all these examples. But I'll give you an example that happened today. I was doing a talk at the Denver Press Club. And the Denver Press Club, you know, they brought the food out and we're eating all this stuff. So I'm sitting there next to my sweetheart, and you know, they put this bowl of pasta down there. And that morning, she had this thing she was going to create today. She wanted something miraculous to happen, just something that was just absurdly miraculous to happen. So, forgets about it, whatever. We're sitting there, they're bringing out the thing, and they plop down the pasta, and it has some fish on it. She smells it, it's like, ugh, that doesn't smell very good. I don't want it with fish. So they bring all the things around, they finally put the pasta down in front of her, no fish on it. Everyone else in the whole table has fish on their pasta. There's no fish, and she's like, huh? I did that. Yeah. So as Joey said in the movie, you know, by you know, when something like that happens, and by, you know, register, and part of the whole trick on this is registering it. Because, you know, if, you know, connecting, because you don't even think. You think, well, I had this thing, I wanted something miraculous to happen. And often in our minds, we think miraculous to happen is, you know, the hand of the Lord would just send it down upon you and give you a Mercedes or something. You know, you're thinking, or whatever you're thinking, and it comes in, and Joey always talks about that in the film, that it comes in these little ways. And so you're just kind of watching, and then the pasta, and there was like a moment, it's like, wait a minute. And then we looked around the table, and everyone else has fish. And like, doesn't. So it's just like, yeah, woo! And that stuff happens all the time, and part of the thing is just always, you know, it's really important to acknowledge it and to go like, oh, that's where it, ooh, look where the rabbit popped out of the rabbit hole. So that's that. So is this the 5-second warning? One more question. Well, I'll see if you haven't asked any. Hi. You know, the question is, have any of the people who did the film do Landmark Forum? And the answer was Betsy had done it something like 8 years ago. She had done it there. Neither Mark or I had. But one of the cool things, one wonderful phenomenon about this whole thing is we've had all these people come up to us afterward and say, oh, you must have done Science of Mind. No, never done Science. Really? What they tell us, like, they say, this is exactly us. And we've heard a lot from the Landmark people because they're all convinced that we've all done it 20 times. But to, you know, and we thought that was really, in fact, at one point we did a test screening up in Seattle and some black Muslims came to it. And afterwards they came up, and in fact they wanted to interview me for their TV show because they said, this is exactly what we teach. And I said, really? And yeah, we talked for about an hour and I'm like, oh my God. It's just, you know, so there's all these little, I call that everyone was in their metaphysical closets doing the thing, and everyone in the closets, we're all a little, you know, we're all a little gun shy, right? Because the society out there will use the C word, it's a cult, you know, or you people are weird. And you know, they do it. So everyone's Science of Mind, you know, we're kind of like this. And I go to Unity Church occasionally, but I don't really go there. And they're kind of like that. And everyone's kind of a little, you know, like this. And so there's all these people and all these little things that have, like, you know, the lights come up at the end of the movie. And they're like, whoa, I'm not the only one. Right, then it goes. So, but, you know, to me it says, like, that's a sign that we're hitting some truth here, that all these little groups have come forward and said, you know, and then we started getting it. The movie came out, and it turns out we were recruiting film for Scientology for a while. It just came out in Germany, and now the press is saying it's a recruitment film for TM. And then, of course, we always heard it was a recruitment film for Ramtha, to which we said, well, if so, we're not doing a very good job because all these people are going to Unity Church because of it, so, you know. So it's really nice that all these different little, everyone's coming out of their metaphysical closets. So, yeah. So thank everyone for coming out of your closets tonight. Bye, book. Bye. Oh, one thing. Ha ha ha. Surprise ending. So, okay, here's the gig. At the end of January, beginning of February, we're going to come out with this 2.5-hour rabbit hole, extended director's cut, blah, 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 blah. And that should, we think we're going to get that in theaters. Quite interesting for people who never saw the original movie, they just seen it on TV or DVD. And it's going to be on Stars, I think, November 6th, 5th or 6th. It's going to be on the Stars Network. So your friends who were just too embarrassed to rent it, you can just tell them they can, privacy of their own home, they can just choose it. And so then we're going to come out with this extended rabbit hole version, because people who haven't seen it in a theater, the experience of seeing it in a theater with a lot of people is really interesting. So we're going to hit that go button and see what pops up. So thanks again. Bye.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Joan Didion, Andrew Weil, Lynn Truss, Blair Underwood, Chris Elliott, Elliot Perlman, Frank McCourt, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on November 2nd, 2005.